Hey, welcome everyone. Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. All over town, they got AA meetings starting up at 8 o'clock, and just about every meeting's reading the AA preamble, and which basically tells us what AA is and what AA is not. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help others to achieve sobriety.
My name is John. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm going to read some guidelines here before we introduce our speaker. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Quote, "Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeaker.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing." And we who elected to come to this speaker meeting tonight made a really good choice, because the guy who is going to share with us tonight really could be called Mr. NABA. He has been all over this place for 17 years since he came in to AA. He knows and loves everybody here. If you've been around for very long, you can't have missed seeing Doug. Usually when you did see him, he was doing something for the club. For many years, Doug has taken care of the buildings and grounds here of the NABA Club, and our ability to sit here in a nice room with the lights working and the chairs all screwed together, were it not for Doug, there's no telling what we'd be sitting in. And I've had the privilege of knowing and working with Doug for a good many years in respect of NABA, and I love this guy, and I'm really enthusiastic about hearing what he has to share with us tonight. Doug Corder, come on up, give your speech.
Well, hello everybody. My name is Doug Corder. I'm an alcoholic. Do I have to have this close? Good. Don't normally need a microphone to speak. Thank you, John, for that kind announcement, and thank you all for being here. As I look out over the room, gosh, I think I know 30-40% of the people in here tonight, because I have been around here for a while. There are some people here tonight that have been here at NABA a lot longer than myself. John's one of them. But I want to tell you, I'm not nervous at all. I've done this before. It's been a while. But I feel like I'm at home here. And I spend a fair amount of time at NABA, being the house and grounds guy on, I can't remember how many different boards of directors here. but I spend a lot of time here, almost sometimes more time here than I do at my own home. So, saying that, I want to get one thing perfectly clear tonight before I even start my story, and that is that there is absolutely no mystery, no chance, no luck, no serendipity, No one coerced me into drinking booze. Okay? I drank because I love the effect, and I ran after it for 28 years. So I want to get that clear. You know, there's no mystery. There was no mystery when I was drinking. And today, as I stand here sober, there's no mystery today as to why I drank booze. I love the effect. Pure and simple. So, a little background about myself, who I am, but for those of you who don't know me or haven't heard part of my story. And then I do it like I was told early on. I'm going to tell you what it was like and then what happened and a little bit about what it's like today. I was born April 16th. Whoopee, I made 63 a little while ago, 1952 in Zanesville, Ohio. I'm a damn Yankee, a Buckeye at heart. All my family is from Ohio. Zanesville is the home of the famous Y Bridge. I think there's only one like it in the whole country. That's its claim to fame. It was central Ohio, not too far from Columbus. Born there, lived there for through third grade. Then my father, who worked at Western Electric, was transferred to Columbus. And I went through the rest of my schooling in Reynoldsburg, Ohio, which is another really famous city, and you all should know about it because it's the birthplace of the tomato. Right? You all know that, right? Tomato Fair, Tomato Queen, Tomato Festival, all that. It's, you know, plaque. You go into town, plaque on the old, it's on the old National Trail, Route 40, suburb of Columbus, Ohio. my family life. I'm from a family of six, mother, father, brother, and two sisters. My father passed away in 2008. My mother is still alive, and my two sisters and my brother. I'm the oldest in the family. my family background is one of church, and a lot more church. My uncle, who is still living in Sebring, Florida, is 90 years old. He's a retired Baptist minister. My grandparents were very active in the Baptist church. My parents were very active in the Baptist church. My mother played piano in the church and directed the choir. From my earliest memories, I was at church. I was a church kid. And that's not a bad thing. I don't want to leave that impression with anybody. It was a very positive experience to have a group of kids that I grew up with in the church and also went to school with, whom I became very, you know, friendly with and spent time with. So I was never really a lonely kid. I was always around, or I'd find something to get into. That's the other thing about me is, as a kid, up in through my adolescence, I was, as my dad used to say, so destructive I could break an anvil. Very hard to control, very hyperactive. I probably would have been diagnosed ADHD today and given Ritalin or something, but I was a real hellion. But my dad kept me in line. He was very, I would say, stoic. He's a stoic type of guy. My mother was the gentler, softer side of the family. But because I was the oldest, I was the lightning rod, and I seemed to catch all of the wrath of my dad. I remember tearing up a barn with a friend of mine in the third grade. I don't know how old that is, but literally destroying a farmer's barn on the inside. And I remember well the discipline I got after that incident came to light. But I needed it, and I'm the kind of guy that says, you know, unlike in treatment nowadays, well, I went through treatment, that's going to be part of my story, but, you know, they always try to get you to blame something on your mother or on your father, you know. That was not the case with me. I had a really loving family, like I said, very church-oriented, and my grandparents were very active in rearing my brother and my sisters and myself. My aunt and uncle, whenever they were in town and not in a church in another state, because my uncle had various churches that he preached in, they were very active in my upbringing. So I had a I don't want to say idyllic, but I had a fairly normal middle-class upbringing. School was where I think probably I learned that I had to stand out. I was painfully shy growing up. I was a scrawny little kid. I'm still not very big. I was too small for some sports. And I found that I actually liked school. If I come across as one of those nerds you used to know in school, yeah, that's probably me. Because I had to fit in. We talk about not being able to fit in and how alcohol helps us fit in. Well, I tried to fit in by doing the best I could in my schoolwork, and then that went into music. Very grateful for the background that I had in the music program from 5th grade through 12th grade, and I'll say more about that. Couldn't play football, couldn't wrestle, couldn't jump high enough for basketball. I did get pretty good at golf. I lettered in golf in high school. So, you know, I was one of the group of kids in my school in Reynoldsburg who were considered, like I said, the nerds, the bookworms, what have you. But school came easy for me. And on through college, I did well in college as well. And again, I did that because I didn't want to be singled out as needing special help. Even though I did have to go to speech therapy in fifth grade, I remember that. Couldn't say my S's, and I still can't. my family life, nothing remarkable about that stands out in my mind about relating to my drinking, other than I just wanted to be left alone to chart my own course. You know, I didn't want anybody to tell me what I could and could not do. I didn't want someone to tell me that I couldn't get an A in this subject or play this piece in the band or, you know, shoot a certain score in golf. I just very defiant, as we read in the Big Book. I'm probably the poster boy for the defiant alcoholic like we read in the Big Book. So when did my drinking start? So that's a background of who I am. My work will come along with my story because my work history, my different areas of work in military, they went hand in hand with my escalating drinking over the years. And by the way, my sobriety date is March 25th of 98. And, you know, by the grace of God. But that drinking career spanned, like I said, almost 28 years. And for 20 years of it, I'll tell you, I had a hell of a time with it. I mean, I had a hell of a great time, I thought. Pretty much all over the world without consequence of any magnitude. But the last 8 years, when I turned the corner, I think you're going to see some heads bouncing up and down like, yeah, I can identify with you. All right, so high school, like I say, I was very schoolwork oriented. I was in all the bands, marching band, stage band, dance band. Love music. I love music today, and I'm really glad to see one of my favorite blues artists in the room here tonight, as a lot of you know. Very pleased to see you. That love of music is a result of one of the three men in my life who were very formative for, I think, who I am. My band director, who instilled in me the idea that hard work and perseverance would allow you to play the trumpet halfway decent. And the second individual that I was blessed to know was a church member of ours who later became my employer at an ice cream store in Bexley, Ohio. His name is Jim Wilcox, and he taught me how to work, you know, how to be an employee. I was a soda jerk in the latter part of my high school years, dipped ice cream and made ice cream, and this guy wouldn't stand for anything to be out of sorts. It had to be, you know, spit and polish, antiseptically clean. It was a food service. They were proud of their family product, and it was delicious ice cream. I eat it every time I go home. So that man was very instrumental in my life. And then, of course, my father, for the work ethic that he always had up until the very end. So those three men gave me, I think, the tools that I used early on to take me where I thought I wanted to go. But as you're going to see in my story, how those tools got tarnished, rusty, and chipped and broken, and eventually just cast aside because booze was more important, drinking was more important. It was just more important. I was in love with drinking. So I started drinking. My very first drink of it was a 3.2 beer in a milk jug that three other of my friends and I, one of the guys was able to get it somehow. We drove out in some farmer's cornfield after a football game and passed it around. I think I had half of a glass of it. I didn't like the taste of it. Didn't like the taste of it at all. The very first drink I ever had, maybe a junior or senior in high school. Didn't touch the stuff again until I went off to college. Went to college at Ohio State University, and that's when the fun began. That's when my little narrow world vision got opened up big time to 50,000 students from all over the world on that campus. And any of you who've been there know it's a big university. So I was awestruck. I guess I could use that word. I was awestruck to be around so many different people from so many different backgrounds. I mean, heck, I had my first African-American friend in college. We had one black family in the little town I grew up. Had one black friend in my high school class. And didn't know anything at all about race relations or any of that when I was growing up. You know, we were just kids going to school. And then to go to Ohio State University and meet not only African-American people, but, you know, Vietnamese and Cambodians at the time, and Europeans, and just from all over. And it was just, I just felt like it was a new world, you know, a new, interesting world to live in. And I was right there amongst it. And, of course, when I went to school there at Ohio State starting in 1970, we had the riot after Kent State. The tragic shootings at Kent State, and of course the Vietnam War was going on. A lot of people in this room might recall those years of unrest and protest and the growing pains that we went through because of that conflict. I'll be honest. I was caught up in the hippie dippy doodle group who said, you know, peace make love, not war. And, you know, that was not for me, you know. Yeah, Vietnam, all bad, wrong. But as I went through my second year at Ohio State, 1971, my oldest cousin from southeastern Ohio was captain in the Army Rangers, got killed in a tragic helicopter accident in Vietnam, and I went to his military funeral, and something clicked. Something changed that made me think that, you know, I'm being a little selfish here. This is my cousin. I used to play with this guy. Grew up with him, you know. Stayed weeks, you know, in his house down in Philo, Ohio. And there he is, dead in the casket, you know, with the honor guard and everything. I thought, you know, I need to get involved in this thing. I need to see what he was into and to join up. So before I could join up, I got drafted. Well, it's funny, but it's even funnier how that worked out. I got my draft notice. My number was 23. And I was down here visiting in Atlanta with my folks when I got it. And I was ordered to report back in Columbus, Ohio. And I called up and I said, look, I'm in Atlanta. Do I have to drive all the way back to Columbus to go in? They said, oh, no, just stay right there. We'll send you a new order. You can go in Atlanta. Don't worry about it. We'll get you a new order in another day. One day later, I get the new order to report. And that was the day the draft ended. So I thought, well, I've dodged the bullet. I'm going to go back to Ohio State, knuckle down, and see if I can you know, get my degree. But that picture of my cousin in the casket just it wouldn't go away. And I was living with a couple of high school friends, and one day I just got this urge to go join, and I did. I went and signed up. So I did. I joined up. 1974, Vietnam was playing out. They were starting to, they were withdrawing troops. I joined up, not knowing if I get sent over there or not. Didn't really care. Lucked out, in my opinion. I was sent to Germany. Did a two-year tour over there, and tell you what, the drinking in Germany, for a beer lover like me, I was in hog heaven. Drink. Now, I was enlisted at the time. I was in the Signal Corps. I was in a mechanized infantry unit, driving a track and operating a teletype rig in the back, playing soldier out in the woods. But I was in a company of drinkers who were just like me. You know, every time we had free time, we were, you know, in the barracks drinking. We were in the NCO club drinking, or wherever we out in the guest houses drinking. We used to go guest house hopping. Riding our bicycles around all the little, if you've been to Europe, all the little towns that are real close together, and every little town has their own brewery, and we'd stop and have a beer at this guest house and a beer at that guest house, you know, and try to make it back to post, still able to ride a bicycle. That was difficult sometimes. But I love the Army, and I don't want to dwell on it too much, but I got a lot of good things out of being in the Army. That stay with me today, and I'll just run through that. Even though I didn't finish my degree at Ohio State, I'd been there for 4 years. I didn't have enough credits to graduate when I joined the Army. When I came home from Germany, I stayed in the active reserves, and I was stationed down at Fort Dillon in an Army security agency company. And my company commander pretty much ordered me to go off to OCS and get my commission down at Fort Benning. I thought, well, I'm going back to school at Georgia State. I'm going to finish my degree. An extra few bucks in the mail wouldn't hurt. So I went and got my commission. Was going to Georgia State, working to finish my degree. And within a year, company commander says, you still single? Quarter? Yes, sir. Well, you're going to go off to flight school and learn how to fly helicopters.
Man, this can't be happening to me.
Most wonderful time of my life, hands down. I love a challenge, and that year of learning how to fly helicopters challenged me mentally and physically, I guess, more than anything I've done before or since. Loved it. And so when I came back, I had a flight detachment up at Dobbins as commander of for the next 10 years. Flew out of Dobbins for 10 years, all around the country and everything. Just loved flying, loved aviation. But at the end of that period, I went into what they call the Individual Ready Reserve. Oh, and by the way, all this time I'm in the Army, after I got my commission and flying, I was still up in my drinking. I mean, you know, if you've ever known an Army pilot or combat veteran, Terry, you know, we just love to drink. You know, we finish our jobs, we just love to drink. We hit the flight, after the flight line, it's the bar. And I flew with some Vietnam vets who were just hellraisers when they got, you know, a few beers or whiskeys in them. And but we were always able to keep it within the line. We called it 12 hours bottle to throttle. And I was religious on that. I never ever mixed booze with my flying, thank God. But when I went into the individual reserves, the first Gulf War hit, and I was a caretaker for my ailing grandfather when I was living in Decatur, and was scheduled for a flight tour at Fort Stewart, and I had to miss that because my granddad was dying, and he finally did pass away. But they told me I could reschedule that same year. But as you all may recall, that conflict was over in pretty much 30 days, and then the military got cut, and because I'd missed that flight tour, I had a, what they call a bad year for promotion. I was a captain. I was up for a major, and I got passed over, and that was the end of my career. But I've been in the what they call the retired reserve since 1993. I get a free license plate. I get to go to the VA, which I'm a proud supporter of, but I don't draw a military pension or retirement. All right, so I'm out of the military. I'm at Georgia State. I did finish my degree. I was on the 12-year plan from start to finish. I graduated with honors in political science with a minor in philosophy, because that's what they told me I had to get into if I wanted to go to law school. And I got into the second Georgia State law class before it was even accredited, because I wanted to be a lawyer. I still think that might have been a good course for me. But anyway, something happened. Along with the drinking, something called falling in love at the wrong time. And I won't say with the wrong person, but I did. Second quarter of law school, I fell in love immediately. Love at first sight with a woman. And it was pretty much drinking and romance and the heck with law school. So after a year, I just decided I was not cut out for law. And a job opened up at a local country club because my mother actually was the executive's secretary. My sister, my oldest sister, was a real estate agent there. So they said, we need a bartender. Would you? And I'd been in the bar business. I'm going to backtrack a little bit. After I worked at the ice cream store back in high school, a bar owner in Columbus asked me if I wanted to become a bartender and make more money, and I said, hell yes. And that's when my drinking really kicked off at a high state, because it was a German bar, a working class neighborhood in South High, if anybody's from Columbus. I can mention the bar, it's Plank's Cafe. And learned how to drink any kind of brown whiskey you could imagine. The bar business was not foreign to me on either side of the bar. I had fun being a bartender, you know, because I had access to the liquor cabinet. And so I took the job at the country club being the bartender, and within short order, the country club manager quit. So the president says, you want to take on the club manager job, even if you decide you want to, you know, go back to law school or whatever, you know, you know enough about the operation, I'm sure you can run it. Sure, why not, you know? More money, more time to drink, another liquor cabinet with the key. So I got into the country club business, and good goodness, I mean, country club people are, well, they're nice people. They're golfers, like me. I was a golfer, but you know, golfers like to hit that 19th hole, and so I hosted all those 19th hole golfers. And we catered a lot. I had a lot of Christmas parties and holiday parties and business luncheons and what have you. And, of course, it was obligatory for me to mix and mingle with all my clients at these things. And that was more drinking. So, you know, drinking is just, it's just heavy. It's just heavy. All I could drink, whenever I could drink, all I wanted to drink. I mean, that was how I drank from drink number two. And drink number two, which I didn't mention, was at my best friend's college wedding reception back in Columbus, when he took me to the booze table and says, what do you have? And I said, all I'd had was one half of a glass of draft beer, and he gave me a gin and tonic. Man, I'll tell you what, that set me off. That gin and tonic is what did it. And then I had a couple, two or three more, and the next thing I know, he was shaking me and waking me up in some corner of the reception in the church there, and then driving my butt back to the rooming house. How embarrassing. But that's that's when I fell in love with the effect that I got, that you know, freeing. I'm not shy anymore. I'm not insecure. I'm not a puny little pipsqueak. You know, 10 feet tall and bulletproof. I mean, that's what booze did for me. I mean, I wanted to be the life of the party. And all through my drinking, around here in Atlanta, there are bars that remember me and my antics because I like to have a good time. I was not a stay-at-home, drink-at-home drinker. I wanted to be around the bright lights and the bright bottles and the pretty women. And one of my female bartender friends accused me of questing. I was always out there questing, you know, on that quest, like Don Quixote.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, that 20 years of, let's be honest here, promiscuity before I met the love of my life at Georgia State, you know, word gets around. Let's just put it that way. We all know about that. You know, you have a history in every bar you go to. If you go there long enough that, you know, there he is again. Is he going to skip out on his tab? Is he going to start telling bad jokes? I literally got thrown out of a bar in Little Five Points by the bar owner picking me up by my belt and throwing my butt out onto the sidewalk because I would not quit telling bad jokes. I wouldn't do it. I love to get people that, you know, that screw up your face like, oh no, not another one of those. And it just, I see sick stuff like that because I wanted people to laugh, you know? I don't want anybody around me not laughing, you know? And I'll keep buying the drinks as long as you all laugh at my jokes, no matter how bad they are. Back to what happened with the country club business. Well, you know, like I say, at this point, my ex, I call her my ex, we were living together, and I was at the club as a country club manager. It was a small country club, and that lasted for 6 years. We had some ups and downs, but it was a relationship that... I guess in doing my step work, I guess I would characterize it as trying to control someone or to make someone fall in love with you. And that just does not work. She was not the marrying type, shall we say, no matter how many hundreds of times I must have asked her. But it wasn't meant to be. And it wasn't meant to be because I was a drunk. I didn't know it. I mean, people called each other drunks in every bar I used to drink in around town here. But you know, it was just part of the deal. But alcoholic, you know, what's that? Well, drunk. You know, I didn't know. You know, I was in my 40s. I didn't really know what alcoholism was. But as it turned out, in 1990. That was the year that was. I was financially in bad shape. My grandfather was living with me. He was dying. I went to a friend's funeral and went to a wake at our favorite political bar here in town and got pulled over for DUI. And then my grandfather died. And then my ex left me. She just packed up and left. That was utter devastation. That was drinking fodder for the next 8 years. That was my next. That was the time in my life when I could look at heavy drinker went to chronic alcoholic. That was the year, 1990. 8 years of crying in my beer and telling the same sad story about she done left me. Who sang that song, Kinsley? I can't remember. So anyway, what happened? That's what happened. And of course, you know, along the way, during that relationship, I racked up, four DUIs. Yeah, four DUIs, a public drunk, and a bunch of scrapes with the cops where I was lucky and they didn't throw my butt in jail. More social, embarrassing, inappropriate behavior amongst friends than I care to imagine telling you about, but I know you get the picture. I mean, I'm supposed to tell my story in a general way. I was a moral relativist, a people pleaser. Okay, you know, I tried to fit in, and whatever worked. You know, whether it was legal, moral, you know, is there drinking involved? Let's do it. So, what happened? That's how it was. Now, what happened? What happened was, I gotta watch my time. I was at the end of my rope in terms of wholeness. I was feeling like I was mentally losing it. I was in a precarious living situation in my house in Decatur. I was having to move out of that. That's right. I was a 5-year habitual violator, so I had no license, even though I had a truck. I just felt miserable, you know. Just felt miserable. Felt worthless. And after a couple weeks of some pretty heavy drinking, I came out of a blackout on the steps of the old DAC over on Briarcliff Road. Literally came out of a blackout. Now, I knew that place was there because I'd done 2 how to drink and drive schools, as I call them, at the old GMHI. Those of you who have taken those things, they're ridiculous, you know. 2 drinks a week, you know, never on a weekend for an alcoholic like me. Are you kidding me? But so I knew that the recovery, the DAC recovery, old Coca-Cola mansion was there, and I wound up sitting on the steps on a Friday afternoon, and a guy by the name of Fred Patterson came out there and took my shoulder, put his hand on my shoulder, and he says, what are you here for? And I'm crying my eyes out and blah, 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 and he said, you know, you're in the right place, we can help you. And I just felt this something, you know. Felt this chill, or it was not chill, like a warm, fuzzy feeling, I guess that's a better description of it, going all down through my spine. And I just knew at that moment I'd done the right thing. I'd surrendered to some total stranger into a treatment program I didn't know a thing about, but I just felt like I'd done the right thing, you know, God. So I signed up like this, you know, take me. They locked me up for 7 days in detox at the old Fox Recovery. And that's where I saw alcoholism in its saddest state. There was an old guy came in, well-dressed elderly gentleman, sat down next to me at the intake bench and started yelling and screaming at the top of his lungs about the rats running up and down the hallway. He was having VTs. I'd never seen that before. Totally freaked me out. So after I got out of detox, I went right into the DAC program. It was an after-hours program. I was able to go back to work, and 4 nights a week from 6 to 9 o'clock, I was in treatment over there for what was supposed to be a 6.5-month treatment program. Well, I was a smart-ass going in, and I didn't want to be a smart-ass going back out and get drunk again. So I extended that 6.5 months to 16. I wanted to make sure I knew every darn thing there was to know about this thing here called alcoholism, and I learned it at that. But I finally was asked gently and kindly to move on out, which I did. And so I have high regard for that program and what it did for me. I didn't mention that when I got out of the country club business, I fell into the construction business just on a whim. I'd done some painting in college and some paper hanging, and I started doing that, and I started branching out, doing more for some friends and family, and I just fell in love with it. And today, as I stand here, that's what I do for a living. I'm a remodeler, and I love my work. I'm self-employed. I get to be my own asset, and my own biggest deficit sometimes, but I have no one else to blame but me, and I like it that way. And I'm able to employ some people in the program from time to time, and I get to carry the message. I get to carry the message to a lot of my customers. I'm building a bar right now for a lady who doesn't even drink. I'm serious. This is my 4th bar that I built. Didn't have a bottle of booze in the whole house. And I said, where's all your booze? She says, well, I don't drink. And I said, I don't either. Oh, really? You know. So I told her my story. Now, this isn't for everybody. I don't encourage everybody to break your anonymity like that. But in my line of work, I find that I'm in people's homes for quite some time, and I get to be, in some cases, almost part of the family. And people confide in me. And I'm really blessed that I can give my story to some of my friends who have a problem drinking, and how there's a way out. All right, so I need to keep this thing wrapped up. So that's how it was, and that's kind of how it started to happen with that hitting that bottom on those steps, going into treatment. And then my counselor, because he was such an insightful guy, said, "You're a real alcoholic, Doug. You're going to go over to that NABA club where all the real drunks go, and that's where you're going to get your paper signed." And that's why I'm here. Now, I've been here ever since. I've picked up every single chip in this room or the room next door. I came in. I told myself to be a good little dumb soldier and listen and shut the heck up. And I listened to a lot of old-timers in that room next door tell their stories. I got to identify with them and feel like I'm part of. And since that day when I walked through these doors and I was introduced to the people that used to sit in that room over there, this place has just had a feeling of home. And that's why I hold it in such high regard. I learned about the history of our club and where it came from. All those pictures out there on the wall, those people that gave of themselves. And I figured, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous tells me that when the hand is outstretched for help, you know, my hand should be there. And I feel like I would not be here if I had hit that bottom on the steps of the old deck, the way my drinking was going. So if there's one thing that I impart in my story is that through all the opportunity that I had early on that I drank away, my life today sober and what I'm able to do today with that sober life, both outside of the rooms and here in NABA, makes it all worthwhile. I love this club. I love my home group, which is the 545 How It Works group. I've known people here, some people here longer than anyone I've known in my whole life. And you are my friends. You're my family. I look forward to every meeting I attend here. And kind of like going back to my church days, when I was told to give of my time and my talent, my tithe, here I found I can give some time. I can give a little bit of talent, hammer some nails or paint some stuff or fix something. There's always something to fix around here. And a little bit of money in the basket. And that's how AA thrives in this NABA club for a good long time and will into the future. So I guess, Tim, I'm out of time. But I want to thank you for being here tonight. I do dearly want to say that the friends I've met in AA are the friends today that I rely on. And I didn't mention sponsors because, and again, this is me. This is not everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a sponsor because I went through 16 months of treatment, and I bugged my counselor into hearing my steps, all of them, in treatment because I was there for so darn long. But when I came here to NABA, I started meeting some gentlemen in that room next door who I highly admired, and some who are still here I still admire, and there's a couple here in this room. And I'm not afraid to go talk to these gentlemen about life issues, and I have done so. And whether you know it or not, just my friends in my home group that I meet here at NABA, when we're talking to each other, you're sponsoring me. You know, you're helping me through my day and telling me that it's worthwhile to be sober today and not be drunk. And I'll close with saying that in that second year here at NABA, I was still in treatment. The obsession to drink alcohol it was gone. And that's an indescribable feeling that I know a lot of you like to reflect on because it's unmistakable. I always say it's like getting poked in the eye with a sharp stick. When that happened, I knew there was a God in my life, which I don't claim to understand. But I do rely on and I do have faith in because of my sober track record since that day, that fateful day in 1998. I've been able to look forward and look and be happy about what I've got on my plate one day at a time. No matter, you know, the challenges I have at home or at work or whatever, they're nothing. They're nothing like the challenge of getting sober. But once you're in here, there's nothing like sticking around because then you never have to come back. So thank you all.
Beautifully done, Doug. We really appreciate it. That is what I call fine craftsmanship.
It'll never leave if I give it and drink.